Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby. Joining me is Claire White.
Hello.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. Today we're talking about Ghost in the Shell, which is a loaded term these days. I'm going to give a brief introduction on what Ghost in the Shell is, because it's actually a lot of things.
Yeah, I'm very excited for this introduction.
It's a little confusing. Try to keep up. So, Ghost in the Shell is the 2017 live-action adaptation of the early 2000s Japanese anime series, which was a continuation of the 1995 anime movie, which was an adaptation of a 1989 Japanese comic, aka a manga.
I feel like you need a timeline or a graph.
And you totally do. You got all that? So, it started as a comic in the late 80s, was then an animated movie, was then an animated show, and is now a live-action movie.
Okay, I understand that one.
It's a lot of things. It's a sweeping franchise. So Ghost in the Shell follows the wily misadventures of Major Motoko Kusanagi, who is often referred to as just Major, especially in the very American live-action remake where her name was changed from Motoko to Mira, and she was played by Scarlett Johansson. Major works as a special agent for Section 9, a counter-cyber-terrorist organization. It should also be mentioned that Major is a human brain inside of an entirely cybernetic mechanical body. The world of Ghost in the Shell is a gritty urban future where the lines between humanity and machine are blurring. It is heavily embedded in the cyberpunk aesthetic and genre, which I will get into later, and the 1995 anime movie has been extremely influential on science fiction cinema. The 1995 movie was directed by Mamoru Oshii, and the 2017 live-action remake was directed by Rupert Sanders, and as previously mentioned, stars Scarlett Johansson as Major, the main character. The original manga was created by Masamune Shiro. Now, Claire is going to be talking about some of the themes of Ghost in the Shell, which are
transhumanism. One theme.
That's one theme, which I actually have no idea what transhumanism is, so this will be very
This will be educational for all.
And I'm doing a sort of production segment on the 1995 movie, a little bit on the remake, and a lot about the cyberpunk genre in general and where that started. So, Claire, why don't you take this away?
I'm not complaining. It was really well done, but that is the longest intro I think we've ever done.
I feel like there's a lot to say about this because it spans
so many things.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this is the thing, is that this subject spans so many different things, and especially the live-action movie didn't seem to carry along a lot of the themes with it, and we can talk about that in opinions.
We will talk about that in opinions.
But one of the few themes that was consistent to the original anime was the idea of humans and machines merging, so I thought I'd explore that. And that is transhumanism, which is a cultural and intellectual movement that believes we can and should improve the human condition through advanced technologies, basically extending your life through technology. Transhumanists are specifically interested in tech that can boost physical, intellectual, and psychological capabilities beyond what humans are naturally capable of.
So is that like maybe the idea of being able to put your personality on like a hard drive or something?
Yeah. And like Major in the movie, she's a human brain in a machine.
In a machine body. Yeah, she is a ghost in a shell.
Yes, exactly. So we're going to explore the idea or how humans might get to being ghost in shells.
Mm.
Now, transhumanists don't necessarily believe in a soul. They believe instead in patterns, which are our identity, very similar to a soul, that is running through our body and will give out. But in theory, they could be transferred onto supercomputers, robotic surrogates like Ghost in a Shell or human clones. Now, within the transhumanist movement, there are all sorts of different schools of thought. Some transhumanists believe that true resurrection can only happen if the body is resurrected too. And they like the idea of supplementing the body with technologies to extend life.
So that doesn't necessarily mean like putting your consciousness on a hard drive. That could be something that helps your cells be able
to... No, they don't actually believe in... This particular sect doesn't believe in that. They believe that you have to, your whole being has to be
somehow extended.
Tampered with technology for that to truly happen.
So your cells, your human cells can only divide like 80 times or 79 times, but to expand that so your cells can divide longer and the body can live longer.
Kind of like finding the elixir of life.
Okay.
Except it's technology that's creating it, which I'm going to get into.
The Sorcerer's Stone.
Yes. I'm going to give a brief history of transhumanism. Of course, I'm adding a disclaimer. I know I'm leaving a lot out. There's big names that I'm leaving out. I have, in theory, 10 minutes on this segment. So I'm cramming in the parts that I think are the most important.
The Sorcerer's Stone.
Maybe.
Really?
No.
Damn it.
No, I'm not going to talk about it. So, humans have always had transhumanist tendencies because death is scary.
It is.
Let's be real. So there have been quests for the Fountain of Youth, the Elixir of Life, et cetera, et cetera. Now, it can also be argued that those particular quests or searches aren't quite transhumanist because they're not really using technology to prolong life. Instead, they're trying to find a miracle to prolong
magic
life.
Magic or something, yeah.
Now, speaking of miracles, let's fast forward to Christian Europe and the idea of the resurrection, which is where, Kyle, you were raised Catholic. I wasn't.
I was.
Where your life and your spirit and your body are going to be resurrected,
yeah,
brought back.
It's a way for people to kind of in their heads at least kind of cheat death, or you know that you'll mm-hmm. you'll live on, whether or not you know that happens. You know, don't want to get into religious debate, but yeah.
Right. Well, most Christians throughout history believe that God would be the one to bring about the resurrection. It would resemble a miracle, something that couldn't be explained.
Mm.
But also throughout time, some Christians have believed and still believe that humans will bring the resurrection about through science.
Oh, and that is very interesting. I've never heard that before.
It's not super popular, but it has had people shouting it throughout history,
yeah.
And people shouting it now.
I kind of like that idea, actually.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, Roger Bacon, and his real name was Roger Bacon, I did look it up, was a friar, philosopher, scientist, and scholar in the 13th century who tried to develop an elixir of life that would mimic the effects of the resurrection. So this is the first time recorded that someone is using science to try and prolong life.
Oh,
or the first cool. time we have evidence of it.
Yeah,
it probably had been done before.
I'm sure the Romans and the Greeks
before.
Were trying to do the
I'm
same
sure
thing.
Everyone was trying to do it. So let's keep on going. The Enlightenment, of course, provided more creative ways for Christians to try and bring about the resurrection, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Some were inspired by Darwin and claimed that humans could direct their own evolution to bring about the resurrection. This is a quote that I pulled. "The day will be divine, awesome, but not miraculous, for resurrection will be a task not of a miracle, but of knowledge and common labor." And that's Nikolai Fedorov, a Russian Orthodox Christian philosopher.
And if you look at the idea that you ideas in Ghost in the Shell, that like of maybe potentially putting a consciousness in a hard drive or a place that can be stored forever, that's actually really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what they were talking about during the Enlightenment.
They didn't know what a hard drive was, but they were kind of on to that
idea. They were
on
to it. The actual word transhuman first appeared in Henry Francis Carey's 1814 translation of Dante's Paradiso, which is the final book in the Divine Comedy.
Yeah.
Now, Dante, at this point, has completed his journey through paradise and is ascending into heaven when his flesh is transformed. And the very vague description is, words may not tell of that transhuman change.
Mm.
So it's not really using it in the context that we use it in, but that's where the word first comes up.
I see.
One of the first big advances in transhumanism was in 1923 when geneticist J.B.S. Haldane wrote an essay called Daedalus, Science and the Future, where he predicted that humans would benefit from applications of advanced sciences to biology, but that at first they would be labeled as indecent or unnatural.
That's pretty accurate, like with the whole debate around stem cell research and stuff.
Oh,
too.
Yeah. I feel like any kind of breakthrough that tampers with our bodies or makes humans act more godlike is always scary.
Yeah.
And people always have very strong reactions to it.
And it does bring about a you know, anxiety of like, what can this mean in the future?
Yeah. What will humans become? In 1949, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, a Jesuit priest, argued that in the future, machines would be linked to a vast global network that would allow human minds to merge. This would eventually lead to an intelligence explosion, or an omega point, which would allow humanity to break through the material framework of time and space and merge with the divine.
Oh, wow.
Which I kind of feel is what Ghost in the Shell is about.
Yeah, that's definitely very much like Ghost in the Shell. That's super interesting.
Mm-hmm. And this is the 50s, before hard drives were a
thing.
Damn.
That's awesome.
Most people consider the first user of the term in the context that we would know it today to be Julian Huxley, who was a close friend of Teilhard's, the priest I mentioned just earlier. And he expanded many of his ideas, but he didn't believe they needed to be grounded in religion. In 1957, he used the term to describe humanity trying to overcome its limitations to arrive at fuller fruition. The idea was expanded over the next few decades. The movement that we would recognize today came to prominence in the late 1980s in, of course, San Francisco.
San Francisco, hippest place in the world.
Popularized by the tech industry and people who tended to have libertarian streaks. They first called themselves Extropians, and Ray Kurzweil was one of the first to make the ideas mainstream with his book, The Singularity is Near. And he actually became the director of engineering at Google, which helped lend credence to his opinions.
It certainly does.
Today, transhumanists include Elon Musk, who is the billionaire CEO of SpaceX and Tesla, Peter Thiel, who is PayPal's co-founder, and people in the movement are fairly rich and influential, some of them at least, and they've founded think tanks and helped establish universities, and their musings are now being embedded into emerging technologies. They also have a political party in the U.S. founded by Zoltan Itzfan in 2014, and they are dedicated to putting science, health, and technology at the forefront of United States politics.
Why have I never heard of that political party? Because that would totally be something I'd at least look into.
Maybe vote for.
Possibly vote for.
Well, I don't know why you haven't heard of them. Because on their website, they brag that they trafficked fifth overall all formal political parties in the 2016 elections.
That's not bad. Like, maybe this could gain some traction, provided, I mean, my only concern is Zoltan Itzfan sounds a little bit like a cult leader, but I'm sure he's...
It's just the name.
It's just his name. He's a very scientific man. I'd love to look at this up more. This is really interesting.
I'll post some articles on the Facebook page. And they were founded in 2014.
Yeah, so it's pretty new.
So in 2 years, that's not bad.
That's not bad.
I'm sure they have a lot of money behind them. I'm going to list some examples of transhumanist tech being used now. One is running a weak electric current through the brain, which speeds up reaction times and learning speed. This is used by the military to train snipers.
What?
Yeah.
That's a little scary.
Scary, cool, and scary.
Yes.
We also have exoskeleton technology that can help paralyzed people walk again or improve strength and endurance.
I've actually read popular science articles about that, like the modern day, like the equivalent, modern day equivalent of the Iron Man suit sort of thing that operates.
It's so
cool. Hydraulics. Very neat.
And speaking of modern day, just recently, February of this year, Elon Musk, who I talked about earlier, said humans need to merge with machines to keep up. He claims it's about the speed of the connection between your brain and the digital version of yourself. So, for example, computers can communicate at a trillion bits per second, while humans go at about 10 bits per second. This makes humans useless, or so he argues, so it's either merge or get left behind. Musk says he has a deep fear of AI, which is smarter than the smartest human on Earth, and thinks we're in a very dangerous situation.
So his idea is if you can't beat machines, you got to merge with them and join them.
Exactly.
And have little human machine babies. And that way when the machines take over, they won't want to destroy all humans because we'll be mixed.
Or we can compete with the machines
or we can compete
when
with
they
them.
Try to take over.
I gotcha.
Is what I think he's getting at. He says the more immediate threat right now is how AI will displace jobs. His example was the self-driving cars that he's helping to make. Now, he has come up with a brain-computer interface where a single transmitting device is implanted directly in the brain's gray matter and produces the highest quality of signals.
That's really interesting. So that, like, the brain can help communicate with machines?
Yeah, it's supposed to help your memory and help you with technology or work with technology more.
I wonder if that'll go anywhere. And if it does, that's pretty cool. And that's pretty Ghost in the Shell.
It's very Ghost in the Shell. And he says 10 years away, probably.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see. Yeah, we'll
check
see.
Check in 10
I feel
years.
Like I feel like Elon Musk has a habit of like very optimistic timelines on
yeah.
things.
Yeah, you can't say he's not ambitious.
No, that's
true. You can't
true.
Say he's not
that's
trying.
True. I really like Elon Musk and I like what he does, despite some people in this podcast having problems with him. Producer James.
Yeah, we won't talk about them.
Yes.
Well, Kyle, that's my segment. Now tell me all about cyberpunk.
I will. I'm going to get into cyberpunk and the history behind the genre and where it came from, because that's what Ghost in the Shell is really embedded in. It's embedded in cyberpunk.
Didn't it help usher the cyberpunk movement in?
No, it was a product of the cyberpunk movement, but it helped continue the cyberpunk movement through the 1990s. So cyberpunk, we're throwing it around. What the hell is cyberpunk? Cyberpunk is a genre of science fiction, and I want to flesh out the definition of the genre and talk a bit about its history and roots. I know that this is normally a production segment about the nuts and bolts of business side of things, but the history of cyberpunk is important in a production sense because the manga that created the anime movie that influenced all this science fiction that has come after it, including obviously the live-action remake of said anime movie, was born out of the cyberpunk era of the 1980s, and it was a huge explosion of cyberpunk in the 1980s. So, according to neondystopia.com, which is a website dedicated to all things cyberpunk, and I think of somewhat an authority on the matter.
I think I found that website when yeah, I was doing my research, too.
It's actually a pretty cool website if you're into cyberpunk and you want to get, like, recommendations on cyberpunk books or shows, movies, and stuff. It's interesting. But according to that website, cyberpunk is a subgenre of science fiction that features advanced science and technology in an urban dystopian future. On one side, you have powerful mega corporations and private security forces, and on the other side, you have dark and gritty underworld the dark and gritty underworld of illegal trade, gangs, drugs, and vice. In between all of this is politics, corruptions, and social upheaval. In other words, high tech, low life. Which, and I think that's as good of a definition as you'll get without going too in depth, because cyberpunk can certainly be a lot of things. The actual word cyberpunk comes from a short story by Bruce Bethke from 1980 about teenage hackers. And Bethke jokes that he wished he had trademarked the phrase because he'd be a millionaire right now. Because, it's become the name of a whole genre.
Yeah, that's something you would kick yourself for.
Yeah, but it's not. Bruce Bethke's story isn't often cited as the start of cyberpunk. What is often cited as the start of cyberpunk, or at least the aesthetic, is 1982's Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie directed by Ridley Scott, which is based on Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. We've talked about it before.
Mm-hmm. Kyle loves Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep.
I love that book. I love that author. I hate that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But Blade Runner is largely credited for establishing that visual aesthetic of cyberpunk with the film noir setting in like this dystopian urban city, and it's normally raining all the time, and it oftentimes has a kind of Asian or Japanese feel to it, even if it is set in a Western city.
You know, when you were reading the definition of cyberpunk, I was thinking Asian city.
Yeah.
That was the first thing that came to mind.
Well, that comes back to the whole Asian city, and it's they called it Japanification aesthetic of cyberpunk. Also, you can find in William Gibson's 1984 novel Neuromancer, and that is a novel that's often cited as the beginning of cyberpunk. And it's not the beginning of cyberpunk, but it certainly helped establish the legitimacy of the genre. And apparently, I didn't know this, but I was reading articles about cyberpunk in the 80s. People in America were worried about the quote-unquote Japanification of Western cities, and they were afraid that Japanese culture was taking over American culture in San Francisco and Los Angeles.
Do you remember Back to the Future when Doc in the past is like, oh, this is crap because it's made in Japan?
Yeah.
And Marty's like, well, everyone knows everything good comes from Japan.
Yeah.
So I think just Japan was rising.
Yeah.
Its culture was influencing everyone. Everything was made in Japan.
But when you think about it now, it sounds like such a ridiculous statement. But that is a theme that you find in the beginnings of cyberpunk. And so it's something that is definitely persisted throughout cyberpunk, is kind of a Japanese or Asian feel. Now, the cyberpunk theme and aesthetic seem to perfectly capture the zeitgeist of the 1980s, the anxiety and wonder that prevailed at the dawning of our present era of globalization. And this is something you mentioned about the anxiety of new technologies like affecting people. Cyberpunk was born out of that anxiety of technology in the 80s and like what everyone being connected could mean and what that could do. And it was very cynical to the idea of digitization and technology at that time.
That's why we need science fiction, because we need the what if.
Yeah, like the what if bad stuff. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Someone needs to explore that.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be Elon Musk.
Maybe. No, he's very hopeful.
He's very hopeful.
But I just thought that was super interesting that in the 80s, as interconnectivity and the internet and digitization was starting to really take root, cyberpunk exploded out of that and was like, this isn't good. Maybe the government's going to use this to oppress us, or, you know, imagine the corruption that goes along with this.
They had some points.
They did have some points. So this backdrop and this anxiety about technology is what the Ghost in the Shell manga was born out of. It was a product of that.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So now I want to switch up to the 1995 Ghost in the Shell anime movie, which was directed by Mamoru Oshii. And it's really what put Ghost in the Shell on the map as a quote-unquote franchise. Like, the manga was popular enough in Japan, but this movie is what brought Ghost in the Shell and the ideas of it to Western audiences. And actually worldwide, like, it became a big cult following. Oshii has stated that with his movie, he wanted to comment on the present world. And this, keep in mind, this is in 1995, but I feel like a lot of the themes in the movie still ring true today. But this is what Oshii has to say about it. My intuition told me that this story about a futuristic world carried an immediate message for our present world. I am also interested in computers through my own personal experience with them. There are only a few movies, even out of Hollywood, which clearly portray the influence and power of computers. I thought this theme would be more effectively conveyed through animation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a very good point.
It is. And rewatching the 19...
And he does it.
He does it.
We both really like the anime.
Yeah, rewatching the 1995 film, it still delivers on a lot of themes and ideas really
well. Well, it also helps that those themes and ideas are still relevant now.
Yeah.
Which is also a testament to making that movie
yeah.
in 1995, that it's still something we're grappling with.
Yeah, the really intricate relationship between humans and technology that just gets more intimate.
Yeah.
As we
go on. And how do we evolve?
Yeah. So I want to talk about the setting of the anime as well, because I think this is really interesting. He based the setting of the anime movie on Hong Kong, the fictional city of Newport City is what it's referred to.
I just assumed it was Tokyo.
Nah, man, it's Hong Kong. And there's actually a really, really interesting and in-depth reason as to why. So Oshii has stated that Hong Kong's present situation, this is in 1995, had a lot of parallels with the themes he was exploring in the film, one of them being change. And the combination of old and new converging together. Hong Kong is a very modern city built around and on top of an ancient city. And there's this roughly 3-minute long montage in the middle of the film, I don't know if you remember it, that contains no dialogue and just shows pictures of the city, the people, the old shops, the new buildings, the dirty canals, the buildings under renovation. And this setting is a visual representation of the quote-unquote kind of old humans renovating and changing themselves with this quote-unquote new technology. And the similarities or the parallels between Hong Kong and what he's saying in the movie don't end there. In 1995, Hong Kong was under British control. England had about a 100-year lease on Hong Kong. And 3 years later, it was set to revert back to China. So there was a lot of anxiety in Hong Kong.
They're still dealing with today.
Which they're still dealing with today.
Hong Kong is a fascinating city.
It is, it is. But there's a lot of anxiety between with the people in Hong Kong going back to China, and that their culture was different now. They were changed. They were still, you know, Chinese in a lot of ways, but they had this Western influence for so long,
mm-hmm.
and that they were going to lose that. Like, how much of their identity were they going to have to sacrifice to go back into China?
Well, let's just do a podcast on Hong Kong.
We totally could. It would be fascinating. And one of my favorite parts of the 1995 animated film is when one of the main characters is facing an evolution of technology, and the character's worried about changing, and it says, what if I do this, will I change? And the response is, yes, of course you'll change. Everything always changes. And I thought it was so poignant and really well done.
Yeah, I have chills just hearing you say that.
Yeah, yeah. So Oshii's use of philosophical themes throughout this movie and these long 3-minute... you know, montages with no dialogue apparently made his producers a little bit nervous that they wanted more action sequences and less, you know, philosophizing and cityscape montages. And Oshii even acknowledged that to them. That he was like, yeah, you're probably right. More action sequences would make the movie sell better. But he continued to make the movie his way, what he wanted, which was smart and contemplative. And I think that's something that maybe the 2017 remake missed a little.
Yeah, they sure did.
And yeah, because in the end, the producers were wrong. Oshii's Ghost in the Shell became an instant classic that sci-fi TV would borrow from for years. The Matrix, you know, the reigning green code that starts off the Matrix.
And plugins.
And the plugins is directly from Ghost in the Shell or influenced from Ghost in the Shell.
I heard that the Wachowski brothers actually brought Ghost in the Shell to meetings and were like, we want to make this when they were pitching the Matrix.
Yeah, I think I've heard something like that too. Like they've vocally said that they were really influenced by it. Along with even Westworld, the HBO series Westworld right now, the
watch both openings.
Opening credits of Westworld are very similar to the opening of the 1995 Ghost in the Shell anime. And here's where I'm going to bring up the most recent incarnation of Ghost in the Shell, this 2017 live-action remake, because it seems to me like the writers and director of the remake did exactly what Oshii's producers wanted him to do and were punished for it by critics and at the box office. And I don't even want to go too much into the remake because I think the 1995 movie is a lot more interesting to talk about. I will, however, give you a quote that I think sums up my disappointment for the movie quite well. And this is from the director, Rupert Sanders. So this is the guy who directed the remake of Ghost in the Shell. And this is what he says about it when he was planning this movie. He said, I took a lot of stills from the first film, the 1995 film, its sequel, and the anime, and I collaged the stills together, and I kind of picked what visuals I liked, and then I tried to weave a story through them. I've never been much of a writer.
Whoa. So he wrote it?
I think he's not credited as writing the script, but I think he kind of outlined the story for writers to then script.
Oh, wow. That makes a lot of sense.
Doesn't it make a lot of sense now?
That's so painful, especially when the anime had so much thought into it.
He also mentions that he thinks in the anime, the philosophizing is on the surface, and the plot and characters are kind of underneath. And he says he can't do that in a live action movie.
Why not?
That's what I would say. I would say, why not?
I certainly think it can be done.
Yeah. Or you can find a balance. I think The Matrix is a great example of that. There's a nice philosophy in there.
There's so many indie movie directors who would be screaming their head off at this. And some of them will have done it really well and some of them will have not. Live action movies do that all the time.
When I saw that interview with him and he mentioned that, I was like, oh, that's what the problem was with this remake. It's style over substance. He picked the shots before he had the story.
Oh.
Which I know,
ever worked?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, you can say that the remake visually there were some cool shots, but a couple cool shots does not a good movie make.
No.
As grandma used to say. So Ghost in the Shell is unlikely to turn a profit, or at least much of a profit. It opened to scathing reviews in the West, and it has underperformed in China and America.
China's the real twist of the knife.
Exactly. But despite the whitewashing controversy behind Scarlett Johansson being cast in a Japanese role, it's had its most positive audience response in Japan.
Oh.
They like it the most in Japan. They're down with it. But Japan just isn't as big a market as America or China would be. It had a budget of $110 million and has so far grossed domestically $37
million.
Ooh. Which is not great. That's domestically, so it has had more worldwide, but they're not sure if it's going to recoup. It's got a 46% critic score on Rotten Tomatoes and a 61% audience score. I think now it's time we'll switch to opinions, and if you've made it this far with us in the podcast, then you probably can understand that Claire and I thought the remake was a little disappointing.
Yeah, I have as one of my bullet points, did the movie miss the point? I don't think we even need to talk about that,
movie,
do we?
100%
the live-action movie.
The live-action movie missed the point, I think.
Yeah.
You can check that off the list.
Just especially, and I don't want to give away any spoilers for either if you haven't seen them yet, but in the themes that it's exploring and the direction that the anime takes it versus the direction the movie takes it, it's completely different, which made me wonder, had the director or the producers of the live action actually seen the anime?
That's what I was wondering. That's what made me look up Rupert Sanders, the director, because I was like, did he see this or was he just like kind of brought on to direct a franchise and hopefully start something? And he said that he was introduced to the movie in art school and loved it. And I think you can see a certain love of it in some of those shots because he is literally taking shots from the movies
beautiful.
And the show.
They're also setting it up for a franchise, which they were hoping it would become.
Yeah.
You can tell that. Which this movie is not a franchise movie, or you might not have some of the characters continue on in the franchise.
Yeah.
You know, you could do a lot with the world.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I just wonder if they're actually going to do a franchise just how based on how poorly
performed. No, they're not going to. Yeah. And I'm sure Scarlett Johansson does not want to come back for another round of what she went through.
I wouldn't imagine that she would.
Because when, granted, I don't necessarily blame her for taking the part because I do think there is a lack of great female lead roles. And
yeah.
So when you get offered a decent one, I'm sure you take it and something that will make you money and won't humiliate you completely, you hope. But she got a lot of flack for playing a Japanese character, quote unquote. And the movie deals very poorly with it being set in Japan.
It does a terrible job. I think there was a way that it could navigate it and not have it be too terrible.
Right.
And it totally
just
missed
the way
that
they
mark
intersperse
too.
Japanese characters, how many there are.
Yeah.
I think they had this idea that it was going to be this mixed race future where there's populated by all sorts of different people.
Yeah.
And they just did a horrible job of it.
They did not do a good job about, creating this kind of, it's a city of everyone.
No,
it didn't really.
No.
The city wasn't populated by anyone either. There was no one in that city.
Yeah.
That's one thing in the anime. It's like you see the markets and there's all these people around and
right?
it's dirty.
That's one of the big scenes
unclean.
Where the guy is, she's Major is chasing a bad guy and he's running
through a market
with all these people.
There were no other people in this film other than like the villain
main characters.
And the main characters. Yeah, and the team, the Section 9 team. And this is something I was thinking as I was doing the research for this, is there have been some Japanese, American adaptations of Japanese films that have worked really well. And I thought of The Ring and The Grudge, which were, they called them J-horror films.
Yeah.
And they kind of spawned a quick little J-horror renaissance in the West where we were remaking a bunch of Japanese films. But it wasn't, whitewashing or it wasn't perceived as bad. Do you think that was a product of the time or do you think that that's something that those films could do?
No, because I think America all the time will take a foreign film that is good or is done very well and then they'll make it American.
Yeah.
Let the Right One In is one that I can think of right now.
Yeah. Which I never saw the American, did you? American
version. I never saw either of them.
Oh, the original's cool.
Right. And I think also with globalization and with Netflix and live streaming, it's becoming less and less of a thing because Americans have access to
all these other movies. That's true.
Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I know it was a really popular book, but they made the Swedish version first. And then we made the American version, which was better.
Yes. And that's something I just was wondering what you had to say about that. Yeah, if you had any opinions on that. Because I think, do you think there's a world where Ghost in the Shell, American version, was set in New York?
Yeah, and it would be
totally
fine. And it wouldn't be called Ghost in the Shell. It would be called something else, but based on Ghost in the Shell. I think it's the fact that they called it Ghost in the Shell. They set it in New Tokyo, whatever they called it.
Yeah, I don't even know if they called it Newport City in the movie, mm-hmm. in the remake.
And then they went and they casted Scarlett Johansson to play the Major, which granted, the Major in the anime has blue eyes and black hair. And I read that the original creator of the anime didn't have a problem with it at all and said he'd envision Major as a white character, actually. Yeah, and that opens up a whole nother can of worms.
Yeah, we probably can't get into too much today. But
Japanese culture and how they've assimilated to Western culture. Anyway, we could do a whole podcast on that, which I would be nervous to do.
We would ask one of our Japanese-American friends to come on and do it for us.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of the problem in Ghost in the Shell, this remake, even in America, is that they could have used a Japanese-American actress to play Major.
Yeah, they could have. And I'm sure there's plenty of great Japanese-American actresses who would love the part.
Yeah.
I think they also, to the studio's credit, they probably thought Scarlett Johansson would sell the movie.
Yeah.
And I also felt that a lot of this movie was for the nerd boys so they could look at Scarlett Johansson in a skin-tight nude suit and very specific shots that would appeal to said nerd boys.
This is true. This is true. I bet that was a big...
a big factor.
A big marketing
And some of
factor.
The fight scenes, too. It was like, this is not made for real fans of the anime. This is made for the nerd boys you think you're attracting because it's based on an anime.
Exactly. Exactly.
But it's funny because it was a movie starring a woman that wasn't made for women.
No. And I wonder about that. Like, I feel like that trope of the flippy, badass, gun-fu kind of, you know, flippy, somersaulty woman is, it's like, that's all that this movie was. That trope packed in a Ghost in the Shell box. And I feel like if you want to watch something like that, watch Fifth Element.
Watch The Matrix.
Watch The Matrix, you know?
That's where it's done well in a good story. And at least in The Matrix, there is a kick-ass woman in that.
Yeah, that's true.
She's not necessarily the lead. And they sexualize her less than they do Scarlett Johansson.
I know. That's another thing. I was getting flashbacks to the kind of anger I was feeling towards about Margot Robbie in Suicide Squad. I'm like, you have this great talent. And all you do is ask
and Scarlett Johansson
over.
Is a good actress.
Yeah, she is. She's a great
talent.
And
the script was so bad that she can't help it.
Yeah.
She's not so good that she can make a script out of nothing.
That she can pull this movie out of the pits.
Yeah. But I want to go back to the anime and how we've talked about this in our podcast before, especially when we talk about the Big Book of Sci-Fi, which we talked about in August or something of last year. But we talk about when sci-fi predicts the future. And I feel like the anime predicted the future.
Yeah.
And we're not there yet completely, like humans merged with robots, but the fact that this is something that could happen. Oh, and it did happen. This is where humanity is going. Oh, and they did go there.
Yeah. And it raises a lot of questions that in 1995 you thought like, oh, that's so far off.
So
we'd never have
off.
To ask the question of what it means to be intimately acquainted with a machine.
Brain implants are 10 years away, Kyle.
Brain implants are 10 years away. And even now, just like how glued to our devices we are and how
May
when
as well
you
get them in our brain.
When you leave your phone at home, you have like a phantom limb syndrome for that phone.
Yeah,
we are very close to having technology integrated into our bodies. And I think the questions and that the anime brings up is still really pertinent today, even more so than it was in 1995.
Right, which is such a missed opportunity for the live action movie because they could have updated it.
Exactly. They could have expanded upon it in a modern setting.
Actually, our producer James has this theory that he likes to spout all the time that our generation, people who are in their 20s and 30s, are the first generation to die with robotic enhancements, but it won't look good.
And then cyborgs.
And then the generation after us will look good. They'll have worked it out. So from James Foey's mouth to this podcast, you heard it here first.
Yes. Yes, we will be the ugly generation of cyborgs. And our kids will be the good-looking generation of cyborgs.
Speaking of, would you get a brain implantation?
Hell yes, I would. 100% would I get
Would you get the first generation brain implantation?
I might wait till they worked out some of the bugs. I don't think I could afford the first generation.
What if you were like the test? They're like, you can do it for free, but we're going to be the first generation test.
Oh, that's risky. I don't know. I don't know if I'd do it then. The test generation and then maybe have my mind
that's when you
like
really
a vegetable.
That's when you really die hungry.
Yeah, I don't know. That's, people would, I'd be old with that first generation implant that they tested on me and the kids would be like, that's what the first gen neural implants
Grandpa.
Would do to you. They'd mess you up.
Grandpa was the test subject.
Yeah.
But look at me now. Because of him, there's me.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, would you, Claire?
I don't know. I'd have to see it first. You know, there's a guy that I work with, and he has a magnet implanted into his finger.
Really?
Yeah, and he is a seamstress and a stylist, so he works with pins all the time and needles.
Oh, my gosh.
But that kind of freaked me out when he told me about it.
That's fascinating. Is that common?
No, but he is a huge sci-fi nerd. And he said as soon as he heard he could do it, he was like, oh, yes.
That's really cool. That is Ghost in the Shell.
That is, but it freaks me out. So my reaction to that scared me. And I was also thinking, oh my gosh, what if it gets infected? That's not natural. What's going to happen to your ring finger?
Well, think about what is it? The IUD, which is birth control that's implanted in you?
Yeah, that's...
And releases...
That kind of is.
Yeah, it is.
Transhumanism.
That is.
I mean, we're not prolonging life. We're stopping life.
Yeah. You know, yeah, maybe putting the kibosh on it, but you're making life more enjoyable, maybe. depending on what you're into.
More livable.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to maybe we can end our opinion segments on this discussion. Is live action superior to animation? I remember being a kid seeing my favorite animes or favorite cartoons and dreaming of a day that they would be on screen. Like, and something like what Marvel does with the Disney movies is up there.
I think it's apples and oranges.
Yeah.
You can't compare.
I don't feel that way anymore. When I think of a good movie, it can be an animated movie. Mm-hmm. It can be an animated movie for adults. And is that something that, because maybe we were brought up with more adult animation, we have in our heads, as opposed to an older generation?
Perhaps the generation that grew up with anime especially. But I think, like what I said earlier, apples and oranges, both genres have their limitations and both genres have their strengths. And it's people who are able to use those strengths and weaknesses effectively are going to make great art. And I'm happy that they both exist. And I'm happy that there's more animated movies coming out nowadays, especially for adults or being made for kids and adults. I mean, one of my favorite TV series, if not my favorite TV series, is Avatar: The Last Airbender, and that's animation. In the era of the golden era of TV.
Very well put, Claire. I couldn't agree more. They both have their merits. And animation can speak to adults. And I think if you are comparing the 1995 animated Ghost in the Shell to the remake, hands down, the animated one is a thousand times better.
Yeah, and you can watch it on Amazon if you have Amazon Prime. Though I have only seen the dubbed version. I hear that the version that is not dubbed is much better.
If you can get a subtitled version of 1995 Ghost in the Shell,
we don't know where.
Take that.
But if you can.
Yeah, get on that. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com, and we would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. You can rate and review us with your ghost and with your shell.
Ooh.
We'll take both.
Yeah.
You can find the show on Twitter at DSRAPodcast. I can be found on Twitter at Klex303. That's KLEX303.
I can be found at Along With Claire. That's CLAIRE.
And you can find our producer, James, at James Fowey Jr. That's James Fowey, F-O-U-H-E-Y-J-R. You can learn more about Ghost in the Shell on our Facebook page, where I'll be posting a beautiful video by the nerd writer on the 1995 movie. It's about 8 minutes long. It's great. I really recommend checking it out.
And I'll post some information on transhumanism and the Transhumanist Party if you're interested.
So interested.
Also, please, please, please tell us if you would become a machine.
Yeah.
Heart machine.
And if you would be in the first generation of that. That's what I want to know.
Would you do it for free if you were in the first generation? This is the big question.
That's the big question. Our producer, who was arrested last Halloween for going as a male version of Major, is James Fowey. Everything was out. It was disgusting. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, who I'm pretty sure has cybernetic art skill enhancements. She can just pop a charcoal piece right out of her index finger and, you know, go to town on some canvas.
Fascinating to watch.
Is that what you do with charcoal?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Thought so. And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, who has the ghost of Casper the Friendly Ghost, but the shell of one of the spider bots. It's very strange. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you in 2 weeks.